July was the deadliest month for U.S. troops in Afghanistan since the war began 8 years ago. The Obama administration has made the fight against a resurgent Taliban a priority, and beefed-up American forces are waging offensive actions in areas of the country where the Taliban has held sway for years. Top administration officials met with U.S. commanders over the weekend to assess how the war's going and consider whether even more troops may be needed. The U.S. and its NATO allies are also trying to develop Afghan security forces in the hope they'll ultimately take over the battle with the Taliban and protect the civilian population. My guest, Anne Scott Tyson, is a military correspondent for The Washington Post, and she recently returned from 3 weeks embedded with U.S. Marines operating in the southern Afghan province of Helmand, a major opium-producing area where the Taliban is strong. Tyson observed U.S. military operations and the challenge of getting Afghan security forces into the effort. She reported recently that Afghan units are undermanned, and she says soldiers once recruited may disappear for weeks to visit their families or take their paychecks home to their villages. Tyson says drug use among the Afghan forces is also a problem. Some are discharged for opium use, but regular smoking of marijuana and hashish are tolerated. Well, Anne Scott Tyson, welcome to Fresh Air. When you've seen these Afghan security forces in action, what's your impression of their commitment and skill?
In the operations that I was on, the Afghan forces were sort of more of an adjunct to the U.S. They were not really operating independently. I mean, for example, going out on a local police patrol in a town in Helmand, it was really the Marines doing the patrol, and the there were six. They had to count them up. They got six policemen to go with them, and they were sort of more or less along for the ride. They weren't engaging with the people. They weren't actively policing the way the Marines want them to. I should also say that Afghan forces definitely can take the initiative in the same place I described the police patrol. I think one day a couple of officers were out buying lunch, and they happened to spot a drug deal taking place and followed the dealer, apprehended him, detained him. So they are showing signs of initiative. They're also, you know, can be quite enthusiastic, quite gung-ho, but they clearly have a different style, a different level of discipline, and they simply aren't capable of acting independently, at least in the South, where they're just starting to have Afghan forces flow in at this time.
And when you say different style, different type of discipline, you mean what?
Well, I mean, such as with their weapons. You know, the Afghans will maybe come under fire and they'll just unload. They won't take aim as well. They won't conserve their ammunition. They'll also be, you know, very cavalier. I mean, they'll be fighting on one hand and, you know, sort of playing dominoes, chasing chickens around on the other. So they simply don't have the focus and organization that the U.S. does.
You know, it's clear that this administration and the Pentagon these days has a focus on Afghanistan. There was a change in the military leadership there, a new commitment of troops. And they want to bring some of the counterinsurgency techniques that appear to have been so effective in Iraq to bear. I mean, in Iraq, of course, there was a big change under David Petraeus when there was a focus on protecting civilians rather than hunting and killing the enemy, moving troops into neighborhoods to protect civilians from sectarian violence, and then, of course, making arrangements with Sunni tribal leaders in some areas to fight with the Americans against the al-Qaeda in Iraq. To what extent do commanders think they can bring these techniques to Afghanistan?
I think that's at the forefront of their minds right now, and I do think that those concepts are trickling down and being embraced by the ordinary Marine and soldier on the ground. Most strikingly, the issue of civilian casualties and the sensitivity over that. Now, that difficulty of protecting civilians when you are in an active combat environment is one that, you know, where I think the tension is most highlighted with these young Marines who are in the middle of firefights. And yet over several days with them, I heard them time and again asking over the radio, do you see any civilians in that area? Are those shepherds? Do they look like legitimate shepherds? How many shepherds do you need for a flock of that size? Watch out for those women and children. Hold your fire. They're women and children. I heard that time and time again. So I think that that is one of the most significant changes that they seem to really be taking to heart. Having said that, it's difficult and frustrating for them because they realize the extent to which the Taliban insurgents are taking advantage of their more stringent rules.
In a piece that you had recently, you had an interesting thought from David Petraeus, the general who was so successful in Iraq and now heads the Central Command. And he said, the biggest lesson of counterinsurgency is that every situation is unique. You have to be very careful that you have that nuanced understanding of the circumstances on the ground. Are there ways in which the circumstances in Afghanistan require a different kind of counterinsurgency approach than it did in Iraq?
Well, on one hand, it's because we have a rural environment. I mean, in Iraq, the population was centered in urban areas. So a platoon could get into a vacated building and be right there in the heart of the neighborhood where they could hear, you know, see, smell, witness everything going on around them. In Afghanistan, it's rural. So it's much more invasive for a unit like that to move into a village and maybe sort of culturally unacceptable. So they have to sort of stay more on the outskirts. And I think that makes it a little bit more difficult for them to be in this sort of protective role. For example, in an area I was just recently in until a few days ago, the Marines would have to go on patrols that were for several kilometers long out into remote villages. They were still going to villages where that this unit had sort of responsibility for the area, but they had never made their way there yet and would be, you know, they show up. A lot of the time, the people run away. They're afraid. They won't speak to them in their homes. Maybe they won't speak to them at all or just off in a field. And they feel very much that when those Marines walk away and walk the even 3 or 4 kilometers back to their base, that they will be immediately visited by Taliban, who will, you know, ask them what happened and threaten them to not have that sort of contact. So I think the terrain and the rural nature of the insurgency in Afghanistan makes it difficult for that reason and in many other ways.
You know, one way is that commanders know that a counterinsurgency strategy is working is when local citizens start giving you intelligence and giving you critical information about, you know, the location of enemy forces, local customs, tribal alliances, terrain, back routes. Did you get any sense of whether the NATO forces are getting that kind of assistance from Afghan villagers in the areas where they've launched these new initiatives?
I think it is happening on a very small scale. I think it's not happening more than it's happening. I mean, for example, I believe that the villagers, through their own actions, showed that they knew when bombs were planted. They knew where they were. But they didn't, for the most part, tell the Marines that they were there.
These are the roadside bombs that are taking a lot of casualties among American forces.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So the Marines themselves would realize that if civilians were out using a particular road, that it was probably all right because they would know if there was something there. Similarly, the way that the Marines would know when they were about to get attacked is that all of the people would run off the fields. They would just vanish and disappear. So that means that they knew that they, you know, the Taliban had maneuvered into an area, was about to launch an attack on the Marines, but of course they wouldn't tell anyone in advance. They're just pretty much trying to survive.
You know, the other thing that was so effective in turning things around in Iraq were the alliances between American commanders and Sunni tribal leaders. Are we seeing that kind of thing happening in Afghanistan at all?
In some parts of the country, yes, I think that that may be happening where the U.S. presence, the allied presence has been there longer. Where I was, though, as the commanders put it, they were in the baby steps of counterinsurgency because they had simply just arrived. So they were trying to figure out who's who among the elders, among the tribes, for the very first time. They often didn't even know who was in charge. And my understanding is that the tribal structure in southern Afghanistan has been very much depleted through decades of fighting that it's not very strong, and in some cases has been supplanted by sort of narco traffickers and you know, criminal type organizations. In the remote rural villages where the Marines were operating, it was just a matter of trying to find someone who could perhaps speak for the village, but there's no real functioning government of any sort, and really not much of a strong tribal presence or community of elders that's meeting on any kind of regular basis. So there's just not a lot for them to tap into there.
Gosh, you know, it just seems like such a desperate situation for these villagers. And I would imagine that after decades of war, from the Soviets to, you know, the Taliban and others, that it would be really hard for them to believe that any, you know, foreign soldiers are really going to be there, you know, and be with them over the long haul.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think that their skepticism, you know, based on their history is probably pretty well-founded. And one other thing that really occurred to me, I mean, Helmand is a desert province. It's a very large area that reaches all the way down to the border with Pakistan. And for all extensive purposes, there really is no border that's controlled. And that's one of the problems, because the fighters from Pakistan flow freely over the border. But the key population center is located along the valley of the Helmand River, which is really quite a fertile area where they have a great deal of irrigation. Helmand used to be the breadbasket of Afghanistan. It's got a lot of potential. And one thing that struck me was that the villagers living there really have basically a decent life. I mean, they have livestock, they have fruit and vegetables growing. It's a very green, lush area that you wouldn't imagine not having been there. And so I think that makes it doubly difficult, because these people are surviving, they are living their lives, and they really don't have a great motivation to sort of toss in their lot with one side or the other.
As I read your description of some of these military actions by American forces in Helmand, this southern area where the Taliban has been so strong, it just seemed like such rough going. I mean, they would go out, engage the Taliban in an area, take casualties. They've been taking casualties on these improvised explosive devices on roads, but then aren't really in a position to get in and provide sustained protection to a civilian area. And I don't want to say that it sounded futile, but it certainly does seem like a long uphill climb to really make a sustained difference here. What's your sense of how the commanders view their prospects?
Well, the one company commander who I spent quite a bit of time with over recent days, that was his big point. This will take time. We can't rush this. He said that he felt he was not getting, you know, pressure from his higher-ups to do more than he could. I think on one hand, though, there is a sort of military dynamic. If you feel like you've seized the initiative, if you feel like you sort of have these Taliban forces, you know, you're sort of pushing them from one out of one area down to another, there is sort of a temptation to perhaps take it a bridge too far. Go for that next village, go to push into the next bazaar, the next area, when in fact that's really not the purpose. And if you don't have enough forces, you can't do that. So in any case, this commander felt strongly that more time is required. He realized that he could only accomplish so much. I also think that there's a sense of pressure from the American public. July was the month of the greatest casualties for the U.S. military in Afghanistan since the beginning of the war. This clearly is creating a pressure to achieve results there. And the defense secretary said, you know, we basically have this amount of time, maybe a year or so, to show that we're actually turning things around.
You know, we're a couple of weeks away from national elections in Afghanistan, and you were there, I assume, while campaigning was occurring. What's your sense of the extent to which people care about it, think it will affect their lives, and also what the American military's view is? Is it important to the American military effort?
It's a very important part of the American military effort in Afghanistan writ large. Where I was, I think that, you know, the election among, in, you know, the people's minds is pretty much irrelevant. Afghanistan is so highly decentralized. I believe that the villagers where I was, you know, perhaps they've heard of the Afghan governor in their province or the capital of Lashkargah, but they are not at all in tune with the national political dynamic. And really, the Afghan government has been completely absent from their lives. They've been in areas where the Taliban has held sway, the Taliban has closed schools, the Taliban has sort of set down the law, and the Afghan government is very remote and really is not part of their daily reality.
Well, Ann Scott Tyson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Ann Scott Tyson is a military correspondent for The Washington Post. She recently returned from Afghanistan, where she was embedded with American Marines fighting the Taliban. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.